Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with approval ratings for Biden's first 100 days, a benchmark set by FDR in 1933 when there was a flurry of bills passed in the depths of a deep depression. According to an ABC Washington Post poll, Biden's approval 100 days into his presidency is at 52%, compared to Trump at 42% and below Obama's at 65%. But since the GOP is now the Trump party and he has convinced his base that he won the last election, which Biden stole from him, little wonder that a sizable sector of the population do not approve of Biden, who they've been told is not a legitimate president. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation, joins us to discuss how Biden is punching above his weight, given his thin margin of control in the House and the Senate compared to FDR's massive mandate. We'll also look ahead to 2022 to determine how Biden can overcome Republican voter suppression and gerrymandering to retain a majority and even overcome the filibuster threshold in the Senate. Then we'll speak with Zoe Carpenter, a contributing writer at The Nation, where her latest article is "Misinformation is Destroying Our Country. Can Anything Rein It In?" She joins us to discuss how, although Trump is gone, the far-right media ecosystem has become powerful because there is no downside to lying. And although big tech may have silenced Trump, progressives should be wary of censorship and find other ways to combat weaponized misinformation. Then finally, we will look into the way populist leaders like Trump, Bolsonaro, Boris Johnson, and Modi have mishandled the COVID pandemic, having ridiculed and rejected science. But now, with 350,000 victims coming down with COVID per day in India, and people dying as they wait in line for doctors and even oxygen, Modi's answer is to cover up his incompetence by banning Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Dr. Sumit Ganguly, the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, joins us to discuss why, in the country that is the world's largest manufacturer of vaccines, only 10% have received one dose and 1.6% are fully vaccinated. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts and was co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And a lot of talk in the press, of course, about Joe Biden's first 100 days. That was a benchmark set by Franklin Delano Roosevelt back in 1933 when the Depression was in freefall. And he was incredibly productive, of course, although he did have a problem with the Supreme Court. So comparisons to Joe Biden, there are some being made, of course, the big difference being that Joe Biden doesn't have the massive mandate that FDR had. He's barely got a majority in the House and a razor-thin majority in the Senate. So it seems to me, Richard, that Biden is punching above his weight.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that it's remarkable in many ways. A year ago, Ian, you and I wouldn't have been having a conversation comparing the prospective Joe Biden presidency to anything having to do with Franklin Roosevelt. It would be much more comparison likely to Jimmy Carter or perhaps Bill Clinton, but not with Franklin Roosevelt. I think everyone has been surprised by the scope and the aggressiveness of the program that he's laid out.
And how much do you see the Biden program with the $1.9 trillion stimulus package already passed and now, of course, a second $2.3 trillion package in the works? So does this mean that Biden has sort of deviated from neoliberal politics?
Oh, I think that's quite clear. The question is how successful he's going to be politically and economically over the haul between now and November of next year, which is the crucial first testing point for all that he's doing. But I think that, you know, what is going to be crucial for Biden's success is how the economy is still doing as we go into the third quarter of next year in advance of midterm elections. And that's a question not just about how the economy is doing, but whether or not the sense of motion on multiple fronts has been experienced by a significant number of voters. So, you know, and there's a dual challenge here, which is one, his ability to use these stimuli to really boost the economy without provoking inflation in certain sectors. And the second is that he managed political perceptions of what he's doing across a host of fronts, heavily tied to issues of race in the case of African-Americans and tied to Hispanic-Americans in the case of the current border situation, which either is or isn't a crisis, depending on who you're asking. So it's a challenging, really very interesting situation. I mean, I've tried to understand why it is that Biden has shown up in this particular way as this particular kind of president. And I think what we have to do is give credit to the fact that there is, in a sense, a kind of Washington insider understanding of what the moment requires for political power, which is distinct from a campaign that's built on ideology or program meant to conform to ideology. In other words, I don't think that Biden has been reborn in some evangelical sense as AOC at 70, whatever he is. What he is a politician who has spent the last half century inside Washington, including 8 years as vice president, where he got to see up close and in very powerful ways what happened to the president with whom he served when the president moved cautiously, trepidatiously, and put bipartisanship ahead of the substance of the program that he was trying to advance. I mean, I think that partly mischaracterizes or is unfair to Obama, but I think it's a decent characterization of the mistakes that he made in the first couple of years around trying to get the collapse of Wall Street under control. He gave too much authority and too much stimulus to Wall Street and not enough to Main Street. And he paid an enormous price in 2010 for it. And Biden is not going to forget that as a politician who first and foremost counts votes.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. And his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. You mentioned, Richard, the problems that Biden has on the border. And clearly, that is something that the Republicans are demagoguing as much as they can. But I think it's an issue that cuts across into Democratic voters as well. And I've actually been getting mail from listeners, and most, of course, my listeners are on the liberal side or the progressive side, saying out here in Los Angeles, Long Beach Convention Center is being turned into a massive housing facility for these young undocumented immigrants that are coming up mostly from Honduras. And people are saying, here, well, how come we're taking such good care of these kids from Central America and our streets are full of homeless? And it's true.
Right.
You drive around Los Angeles, right, and more and more of these tent cities are exploding. It's like these little Hoovervilles are cropping up everywhere.
Right.
So that's an issue that I think could cause him some problems. Do you think it's a legitimate criticism?
Well, I think it's legitimately a real and serious problem. And you're absolutely right. It's not one that's confined simply to the racist wing of the Republican Party, or as some of your listeners may think, the entirety of the racist Republican Party. It is an issue that is reaching deeply into independent and Democratic voters, including, frankly, Hispanic American citizens who have their own questions about this whole process. So, you know, this one does not have, for me, an economist, an easy, direct solution. And I'm keenly attentive to whatever it is that Vice President Harris is going to come up with, since President Biden seems to have charged her with responsibility for vanguarding the administration's new approach to this. So that's one of the I don't think that's an economic problem in traditional macroeconomic sense, but I do think that it's an enormous political problem. And it's a political problem that has been a problem on and off in America for, you know, centuries. You know, in the middle of the 19th century, it was worries about the Irish and the German and the Poles and the Italians. And now it's a worry about Mexicans and Hondurans and Guatemalans and in some cases Asians. And whenever countries go through an attempted rapid assimilation of new populations, particularly populations that are that speak different languages or exhibit different cultural characteristics in one way or another, that creates political conflict. And that's what we're in right now. Roosevelt was in some way blessed. I mean, that's perverse to say, but immigration had been essentially shut down a decade before he took office. It was an issue, and as you know, Ian, in California in the early 1930s, hundreds of thousands of Mexicans who had come north to work in agriculture in California and a couple of other states were peremptorily taken back to the Mexican-American border and expelled from the United States. So there's a precedent here for what has been historically a pretty brutal policy for vulnerable immigrants seeking residence in the United States. And I don't know how it is that Biden is going to handle this. This is a clearly volatile issue that has real voter significance. So,
and of course, the Trump Republican Party have decided to cheat rather than compete. They could win back the House in 2022 and the presidency in 2024, but they could win back the House in 2022 before one vote is cast because of the massive gerrymandering underway.
Yep.
So little wonder that this poll that's come out from ABC News, Washington Post, that approves Biden's work in office, but he's lower than any president at 100 days in office since 1945, except for Gerald Ford, who was at 48%, Biden's at 52%. And then Donald Trump, of course, is at 42%. So for 14 presidents from Truman to Biden, the 100-day average is about 66%, and just 13% of Republicans approve of Biden's work in office, exactly matching the Democrats' disapproval of Trump at his 100-day mark. And, of course, Obama was at 36% approval from Republicans in April of 2009, and George W. Bush had 39% approval from Democrats at his 100-day mark. But given what Trump has done to the Republican Party and how he still controls it, and so much of this voter suppression agenda of theirs is based on this Stop the Steal lie that he's propagated, that, of course, what's inherent in the Stop the Steal lie is that Joe Biden is not a legitimate president. So actually, it's pretty amazing that Biden's getting the kind of numbers that he's getting, frankly.
Well, look, I mean, I think there are several things to say here, one of which is, of course, that it's a little dangerous to focus on the national numbers in a political system that in off years relies on the impact of gerrymandering. So what you want to do is know what opinions are in specific swing districts that can be moved from the blue column to the red column. The second is that you want to know what the impact of that gerrymandering is going to be in the next presidential cycle coming up, because as we saw, although Joe Biden, like Hillary Clinton, won by substantial majority in the total national votes cast, he barely squeaked through in terms of what he needed in four states, basically, that gave him the electoral vote count that ultimately is what elects a president here in the United States because of the system that we've inherited from the 18th century. So I think what I'm keen to keep my eyes on is not sort of national numbers that tell me what the Republicans think or what Democrats think, because I'm constantly telling myself the Republican Party is declining as a percentage of the American population and of the American voting age population. The Democratic Party is growing, but the big factor in American politics is the factors are two. One, independents and which way they break in these coming elections, and non-voters who historically for the last 30 or 40 years have been the largest single block of potential voters who have chosen not to cast their vote for anyone, for Democrat or Republican, because of their alienation for one reason or another from the political system. What has happened in the last 16 years or so is a remarkable awakening among some of those non-voters. And you, I'm sure, with other guests, have talked in some detail about how that more complex mathematics is what's really at play here. I'm not so much worried about the National Republican or National Democratic numbers as I am concerned about where the Democrats can turn out voters who haven't historically been stable voters, let alone stable Democratic voters. And I'm concerned to know how and where the Republicans are succeeding in keeping people, including non-voters, from voting and would-be voters from voting as well, too.
Well, that leads to ask whether we know that the constituency that Donald Trump brought out from under a rock, starting with his Bertha canard, he essentially gave racists in this country permission to be racist again. You know, you can openly strut your stuff, which is what's happened. And, you know, so much of what's happening in voter suppression is racist in its underlying nature. And the debate on statehood for Washington, D.C. is essentially subtext is racism. That's why you don't have democracy in the nation's capital. So chalk that one up for Trump. He brought the racists out from under a rock. Where's the constituency that the Democrats could bring out?
Well, I think, first of all, they're among racial minorities in the country by just simply bringing out larger numbers there. I think also there are independent voters who could swing Republican or Democrat for whom the Democratic analysis of the Republican Party as equal to racism probably doesn't play as well as it plays in among Democratic voters. By that, I mean, I think that there is a constituency that actually doesn't think of itself as racist. Now, we can talk about structural racism till the cows come home, but we may be persuaded, but it is not at all clear that that percentage, which might be as much as 20 or 25% of likely voters, are going to be persuaded by Democratic accusations that any vote for any party or figure who is not reliably progressively Democrat is therefore proof positive that that voter is a racist. That has the potential for backfiring on the Democratic Party. And we just have to see how things go. I think that Joe Biden was unbelievably lucky in the outcome of the jury's decision in the Chauvin trial last week. I mean, I had for several weeks beforehand been trying to contemplate and talking with colleagues about what the impact would be had there been an acquittal or had there been a likelihood that Chauvin was going to be perceived as getting off in this case. So in that sense, Joe Biden is doing politics with a measure of Irish luck that is so far quite amazing. How that holds, how long that holds, one doesn't know. I think the other thing is that the Republicans are trying to figure out, although they can't control this situation, what role Trump is going to play coming into this cycle, because his peculiar characteristic is that he thinks of the party as the Trump party now. And that is in large measure true when it comes to his nomination, if he chooses to run. I think that, you know, were he to run in 2024, right now, I'd have to say that he's going to, you know, drive any potential opponent out of the race, you know, the day after he, Trump, formally declares that he's in. However, for both 2022 and 2024, there are specific races, in some cases in the Senate, in places like Missouri, that could very easily is not the right word. There are four or five Senate seats up that have been held by Republicans that could swing to the Democratic candidate if the Republican primary system, goaded by Trump, chooses such an extreme Republican candidate, that is, such a Trumpist Republican candidate, that it drives Democratic and independent turnout, and it brings in non-voters who are fundamentally frightened and appalled by those candidates. So, you know, we know what the historical likelihood is in a first off year election, which is that the party in power loses seats. And that was the disaster of 2010, that no Democrat, and certainly Joe Biden and Ron Klain and the people around Biden, can ever forget. And, you know, the essence of what they're doing economically and politically, in some sense, is in the most traditional sense of power politics rather than ideological politics. They are advancing programs because they believe that that is what will retain and expand their partisan and administration power beyond 2022 and beyond 2024. Now, I think there's a larger context, but let's talk about that in a moment. You have another question.
Well, actually, we're running out of time. What I wanted to say was the reason we're talking about 2022 and 2024 is that Biden is hanging by a thread in terms of his hold on power, and that the Biden and the Democrats are hanging by a thread in terms of the hold on power. So these elections are crucial. And if the Republicans come back, I think it's the end of just about everything. I don't want to be too melodramatic, but it's just an appalling thought. I thought for a while that Biden was going to be the beneficiary of a massive economic exuberance as the pandemic is brought under control and people suddenly start going out to the malls and to the movie theaters. But because there's so much resistance to getting inoculated, you've got this problem now in this country where you will not get to herd immunity. And as long as you don't get to herd immunity, that means that the virus will mutate into even more deadlier forms. So, you know, we're up against incredible ignorance and stupidity in this country that could not just take away Biden's advantage of having a economic uptick, but also could cause us to be trapped in this pandemic for, you know, years to come.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right. Here's what I would say to gently push back on that, Ian, which is that should the Republicans gain one or both houses in 2022, you're still going to have a White House that is capable of vetoing legislation that comes out of it, so that you're going to have something that looks more like a stalemate. It'll look more like trench warfare in the First World War around the Somme than it will be that there will that will be a sudden, rapid reversal by the Republicans of what Biden has done in the first 2 years. Then that's part, again, of Biden's strategy, which is even should they lose control of one or both houses, he wants so much stimulus, so many programs, so many opportunities for people to once again feel optimistic about America, that that will give him momentum that will be the best possible chance he has of overcoming what the Republicans are trying to do to voting rights for so many millions of Americans right now as their strategy.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
And it's always good to talk with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break back looking into how, although Trump is gone, the far-right media ecosystem has become powerful because there is no downside to lying. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Zoe Carpenter, who is a contributing writer for The Nation, who has received the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism in 2018 and has been a finalist for the Livingston Awards and the National Awards for Educational Reporting. Her latest article at The Nation is "Misinformation is Destroying Our Country. Can Anything Rein It In?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Zoe Carpenter.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I'm sort of reminded in a way of the movie Wall Street, where the main character utters the famous line, "Greed is good." And arguably, from the Republican point of view, misinformation is good. I mean, look what they've done. Trump lost the election. He started the Stop the Steal canard. Maybe he's motivated by personal greed. He has, after all, the former grifter-in-chief. A lot of that money that he's raised, in fact, not most of it, I think goes into his pocket. But nevertheless, it has led to many, many Republican legislators coming up with, 300-plus bills to restrict the voting, to suppress votes very effectively, mendaciously. And in the case of Georgia and in many of these other states, they're actually getting rid of the ability of the secretaries of states and the election officials to actually count and certify the vote. So even if they suppress the vote on voting day, they have a second bite of the apple on vote counting day and thereafter. They can literally change the votes. And that's exactly what's happening as we speak now, Zoe, in the state of Arizona, where a group of complete whack jobs from the Stop the Steal movement have been hired by the Arizona Senate to recount the vote in Maricopa County, which is largely Democrat-leaning. So do you accept my notion that if you're a Republican, misinformation is working out incredibly well for us?
Yeah, I think that certainly seems to be the case in the short term. And I think that's one of the things that Trump and his presidency showed the Republican Party, was that there are very few consequences for blatant lying. And of course, you know, misinformation isn't new. Of course, if we think about something like the welfare queen, which Reagan and then Clinton drew upon to, you know, for a particular policy agenda, that was based on misinformation also. But the brazenness with which Trump lied, I think, really was new, and it was quite effective for him in a political sense, at least for a while. And so I think now the Republican Party has sort of taken that to heart, and there's just been a ramping up of the kind of misinformation and outright lying that we've seen from the Republican Party and then from related outlets like Fox News and the whole media apparatus that supports them. And as you just mentioned, there are real-world consequences to this, not just in terms of elections, but in terms of policy with regard to voting rights.
Well, since the Republicans have weaponized misinformation, what are the antidotes? I mean, one of our earlier presidents, John Adams, said Facts are stubborn things, and whatever our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passion, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. Is that still true?
Yeah, I think it's debatable whether it's still true. In terms of your question about if there's anything we can do about it, I like to think about misinformation as sort of having these three roots. So one that gets talked about a lot is social media. And then there's more traditional media, broadcast media, radio, the sort of partisan outlets posing as journalistic sources or journalistic outlets. And then politicians themselves, people who are in power. And so I think if we're talking about reforms, it has to come in all three of those areas. And there seems to be a lot of attention right now on reform in the social media and big tech space. You could look at antitrust enforcement, perhaps breaking up some of the biggest players like Google and Facebook, and, you know, things like deplatforming. That kind of stuff gets talked about a lot. And certainly those things could all have impact, but I think one important factor about misinformation is it's not just a technological problem, it's also just a power problem. And it seems much more challenging to think about how we reform the GOP, because as long as Republican leaders are willing to entertain and stoke the delusional fantasies of their base, that problem is only going to get worse. And we're in a situation now where the Republican Party or Republican politicians are aware that as many as 70% of their voters think the election was stolen. And so they've almost gone in too far to contradict that. And so I think it's only going to get worse from here. I don't know how the GOP reforms itself if leadership isn't willing to go against the base.
And again, I'm speaking with Zoe Carpenter, who's a contributing writer for The Nation, who received the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism in 2018 and has been a finalist for the Livingston Awards and the National Awards for Educational Reporting. Her latest article of The Nation is "Misinformation is Destroying Our Country. Can Anything Rein It In?" So in terms of reforming big tech, there are, of course, different sort of ideas. The Democrats have proposed reforms to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, but the GOP see it basically, and they've made up again a platform of disinformation. They're saying that these big tech platforms discriminate against conservatives. And, of course, the example would be Trump being taken off Twitter. So how do you deal with those two universes?
Well, I think first of all, we should make it clear that there isn't any evidence that content moderation and other attempts at reform target conservative posts on social media. I think it's very clear by now from both outside and inside investigations that the algorithms that these companies use promotes inflammatory partisan content, and in many cases privileges, you know, right-wing misinformation. So these claims of censorship are baseless, although they are effective politically. I mean, Section 230 is a very complicated debate because there are real purposes and good things about parts of it. And, you know, it's often said that it helps create the modern internet. I think it's also true now that there's a growing interest, particularly among Democrats, as you mentioned, to tighten it up a little bit, maybe not get rid of Section 230 altogether. But for example, to make companies liable if their algorithms spread content that leads to real world violence, and that the content itself, you know, just hosting the content itself doesn't make you liable. But if you're going to reward it by promoting it across the platform, then that could be grounds for a lawsuit. So there are lots of different ideas floating around. Like with anything in Congress, it's hard to imagine finding consensus that would actually lead to a strong reform.
Well, as a journalist, I'm a little queasy about anything that smacks of censorship.
Right. But so, and that, of course, then the question is, well, what is censorship? Because it's a different thing to say you can't post this content to the platform versus you're going to post it and then the algorithms are going to amplify it. So, and also these are private companies. The free speech is really a matter of what the government allows. And these platforms are profiting via spreading this misinformation. And so the question of free speech usually gets really oversimplified. But no one is under obligation to spread and amplify lies. That's not a requirement of the Constitution.
So how do we deal with education itself? Because it seems to me that facts and information are the disinfectant for ignorance, and ignorance abounds. I mean, I'll give you an example. For example, the new senator from Alabama, the football coach, Tommy Tuberville, who Trump, you know, hailed and helped get elected, he believes that his father, who fought in Europe in World War II, liberated Europe from socialism, not from fascism.
Right.
I mean, it's frightening, the level of ignorance and the gullibility and the alacrity with which people embrace completely insane things like the QAnon conspiracy. I mean, this actor, right, Jim Caviezel, who played in The Passion of Christ, the Mel Gibson movie, he just recently at a right-wing conference gave life to this idea that the Democrats are killing babies, not so much to drink their blood, but before they kill a baby, the adrenaline pours through the child's system in fear of about to be killed, and therefore whatever that hormone is secreted is prized by Democrats as the kind of elixir of power. I mean, when you put the loyal opposition way beyond the pale in terms of civilized discourse in the kind of William F. Buckley versus George McGovern style that we used to have, then it serves a political purpose, radicalizing those that believe this and making it seem like the Democrats are, you know, Satan-worshipping child murderers. I mean, you couldn't come up with a worse scenario.
Yeah, these conspiracies are incredibly bizarre. One thing I do think is interesting and worth noting is that although it's easy to chalk it up to ignorance or lack of education, a lot of these conspiracies are appealing and spread because people are doing detective work that does take, you know, a certain amount of focus and intensity, and people have sincerely held beliefs. And I think that was also true in the case of concerns about election fraud, is that people had these experiences. For example, seeing that a vote of theirs had been canceled when they looked online, and it turns out that it was just a mail-in ballot that had been invalidated because they'd actually gone to vote in person. But I think the trick here is not necessarily that people are just dumb, but also that the information universes that people exist in are so sealed off from one another that if you are only consuming right-wing media, you don't encounter inconvenient facts. And so these, you know, the siloing of the media ecosystem is something that isn't going to be solved just by, for example, educating people in media literacy. If they're not seeing other types of media, they don't have, you know, a way to judge what's in front of them.
Well, we've seen how these voting systems companies like Dominion, who have been slandered by talking heads on Fox, are suing Fox for billions of dollars. And presumably that's got Rupert Murdoch's attention. And interesting enough, two former Australian prime ministers, a conservative and a liberal, have come out pointing out that the damage that Murdoch has done, not just to this country, but to other countries like the UK and Australia, where his press dominates Australian politics and he gets to choose who the prime minister is, even gets to choose his nickname. It's appalling the amount of power this bilious billionaire has. So is there anything that can be done about that? I mean, this is just the free market in its most excessive form?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about the free market in the sense that misinformation and this hyper-partisan, personality-driven style of quote-unquote news coverage, whether we think it's news, probably depends on your partisan leanings, but that has been extremely profitable for Fox and then, of course, for newer online outlets like Breitbart. And so there's really very few disincentives to spread this kind of misinformation. And I think the Dominion lawsuits coming from that voting technology company regarding lies about their technology being used to help Biden, you know, steal the election, allegedly, those lawsuits definitely will test some of the boundaries of, you know, the free speech protections, the freedom of the press protections. And again, this is a very complicated area because we need to have a free press. But I think, you know, in this case, the company believes that absolute deliberate lies that were spread on Fox News and other right-wing outlets led to danger for its employees and real damage to its business reputation. So those lawsuits will be really interesting. You know, I think in the long term, having libel lawsuits, you know, up the wazoo is not going to solve the media problem. I don't think that's a particularly good solution. And I think that's trickier than the social media case where, you know, obviously we do really need these press protections.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Zoe Carpenter, could there be an exhaustion factor here? Because if you basically rile people up, which seems to be the MO of Fox, and now you've got even the more extreme ones like Newsmax and OAN and Breitbart, is there a limit to how people can be in a fever of anger against mythical, you know, you would think that AOC was out to destroy the planet, even though she's trying to save the planet. I mean, at what point do you literally, I mean, can you keep people percolated, like on this kind of caffeine high of disinformation forever?
That's a really good question. I'd be interested to talk to a psychologist or a sociologist about that. To me, it seems exhausting, and living your life in a perpetual stage of outrage and fear seems untenable, but, you know, people seem to do it. So I don't know the answer to that. I just think it's a really good question.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Zoe Carpenter, who's a contributing writer for The Nation. She received the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism in 2018, and has been a finalist for the Livingston Awards and the National Awards for Education Reporting. And her latest article at The Nation is "Misinformation is Destroying Our Country. Can Anything Rein It In?" We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking at how Modi, along with other populist leaders like Trump, Bolsonaro, and Boris Johnson, have bungled the COVID pandemic. With 350,000 victims coming down with COVID per day in India, Modi's response has been to ban Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. His books include India Since 1980, India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia, and his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you.
Well, India is under terrible stress at the moment, with the government now reporting about 350,000 new infections in a single day, which is a world record. So COVID has come back in this second wave, which, by the way, the leader of the country, Modi, was warned about this back in January, and he absolutely dismissed it. And he's poured scorn on experts and scientists in the way that Trump did. He was warned that the country faced a tsunami of infections, which is exactly what's happening now. And in response to it, even though there's a shortage of oxygen and people are dying, literally lining up, waiting to get hospital beds and see doctors, they're literally dying in lines. What is his response, Modi's? He's cut off India's citizens' access to Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So is there a pattern here, Sumit, of these populist leaders like Modi, Trump, Bolsonaro, and Boris Johnson in terms of the catastrophic mishandling of COVID?
I think there is a striking parallel, a hostility towards expertise, and particularly medical and scientific expertise, a belief in one's own omnipotence, a belief in magical thinking and an unwillingness to confront ongoing realities. So there is a striking and rather damning parallel.
So at this point, the one thing that's extraordinary about India is that it is the world's largest producer of vaccines, but yet fewer than 10% of Indians have been given even one dose, and just 1.6% of the, I think it's 1.4 million, billion people have got a shot. So what explains that?
In considerable part, it's markedly similar to Trump, who organized Operation Warp Speed to develop a whole range of vaccines, but had no plans for their distribution and the actual inoculation process. In a markedly similar fashion, while India does have substantial capabilities, both private and public, to produce vaccines on a mass scale, there was no plan on how you would inoculate people in a rapid fashion. Modi had devoted scant attention or effort to this particular endeavor. So it's wonderful to have a spate of vaccines, but you also need to have the wherewithal and the infrastructure in place to be able to inoculate people.
And India has the largest vaccine maker in the world, the Serum Institute of India. And apparently the United States just today, under pressure, have relinquished on a ban of raw materials for vaccines, the export of raw materials for vaccine, and they're sending India a lot of, they're sending mostly PPE, ventilators, and other medical equipment, therapeutics, etc., test kits. What was the problem that India had in the first place for this ban? Because the US is being accused by a number of countries around the world of hoarding, and India is apparently relying on their version of AstraZeneca as the main vaccine. So let's start with the ban that was lifted today by the United States.
Right. The ban was because of the Defense Production Act, which Biden had invoked, and under which he had to prioritize the United States in terms of meeting domestic needs to address the virus here at home. And it prohibited the export of ingredients, materials, which are necessary for the production of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And of course, the US has a massive stockpile of AstraZeneca vaccines, and it's still unclear, at least it was unclear as of yesterday, because I heard Dr. Anthony Fauci speak about this, and others also in the administration speak about it, and no one was willing to confirm that the AstraZeneca vaccine, which the US has massive stockpiles of, would be made available to India. However, the ingredients which go into the making of the AstraZeneca vaccine apparently will now be released to India, thereby enabling India to break an important bottleneck in the rapid manufacture of the AstraZeneca vaccine.
And I believe also the Europeans have been asking for the Americans to give up their stockpile of AstraZeneca. Do we have any idea why the US is sitting on AstraZeneca, which, I mean, just having, what, six people get blood clots out of 7 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has had a terrible impact on the rate of vaccination in this country. It's slowing down enormously. We probably will have, at the end of the day, 40% of Americans who won't be vaccinated, which means that the pandemic will rage on, because you need much, much more, a higher percentage to get herd immunity. So we have a real problem in this country with just because of bad publicity about J&J. So I'm not sure what the problem with AstraZeneca is. Do you?
I think the simple problem with AstraZeneca was that I think the administration was shepherding these resources in the event it could not use Moderna and Pfizer in sufficient numbers to vaccinate people. That's at least what I surmise. Otherwise, it makes no sense to simply hoard the AstraZeneca vaccine for no particular purpose. This is a fairly rational administration, unlike the previous one. And consequently, I cannot imagine that they were simply pursuing a kind of an America First policy, a crude America First policy. I think this was largely as a measure of protection in the unlikely event there were any bottlenecks with the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine. That's the only guess that I can, reasonable guess that I can hazard.
And we're just learning from the Associated Press that Biden now plans to share up to 60 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds a Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. His books include India Since 1980, and his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. So back to this fact that the countries with the worst outcomes on COVID, led by populist leaders, Modi in India, which is now experiencing a terrible wave of deaths and people dying because the lack of ventilators, the lack of even oxygen, lining up and dying in lines to get hospital beds and to see doctors. It's having quite a panic reaction within the country itself. And of course, a populist leader like Modi, rather than solve the problem, he's now cut off access to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, etc. So that's his response. Trump was the same, and both of them, of course, are science deniers and heap scorn upon expertise. Bolsonaro is probably the worst in heaping scorn upon expertise. And Johnson, Boris Johnson in the UK was ridiculous in the beginning. Now he's sort of woken up a little, but he has his problems now because his own former right-hand man is now going public with the fact that this guy is a complete incompetent and a liar and a crook. So I don't know. What do you think is going to happen with the politics of India? Can Modi suppress reality in the way that he's trying to do?
Well, for the short term, he will certainly try to do that. And already I noticed that on Facebook that the Indian High Commission in Australia was protesting against a column in the Australian, which was highly critical of India's mangling of the crisis. And of course, the official from the Indian High Commission had to trot out the standard line of the government about how many vaccines it has produced and how many countries outside of India it has helped. And all of this was utterly specious because the facts speak for themselves. But on the other hand, what else is a diplomat supposed to do when faced with this tragic reality at home? She or he is compelled to trot the government's position out. And Modi will continue to do this. I just spoke to my brother this weekend in Calcutta, and he was complaining about the argument that the Minister for External Affairs, Subramaniam Jaishankar, was making that, well, the reason we have vaccine shortages in the country is because we had contractual obligations to others, and we have fulfilled those contractual obligations. Well, that's only partially true because India has not fulfilled its contractual obligations to the states of Africa, and the Africans have now basically given up on India because of India's failure. And furthermore, the point remains that why did you make these contractual obligations when you had a domestic crisis to deal with to begin with?
Well, but Modi denied that there was a domestic crisis. He held huge rallies in West Bengal in the elections there. And so just like Trump did. I mean, the similarities between Trump and Modi are really depressing and so clear. So one of the things that struck me, though, that just gives you an idea of the scale and the horror of what's happening in India, because of all these cremations that are necessary, because people are dying in droves and 350,000 infections per day, world record, you have now calls to cut down trees in city parks to get the wood to burn the bodies.
I am not surprised. Already city parks this weekend were being used as crematoria because the crematoriums are full. In one case in the state of Gujarat, in Modi's home state, the rails of a crematorium on which bodies are placed and then, you know, rolled into crematorium, they melted because of the sheer heat from excessive use thereof.
So is there any end in sight to the death rate and to the possibility of reversing the mishandling of this pandemic by Modi, who's using, obviously focusing on public relations as opposed to solving the problem? But because that so many opposition leaders, so many political activists, and so many journalists have been arrested in the last several months by Modi, is he able to basically silence the opposition?
No, the opposition continues to speak out. Just over the weekend, I was reading an article by P. Chidambaram, who was the finance minister under a previous government and a very able one, loudly criticizing the government in the Indian Express, which is one of the major Indian English language dailies. Along with that, there was a column by Tavleen Singh, who is one of India's most prominent journalists and columnists, absolutely describing the government in scathing terms. So there are still courageous individuals who are speaking out against the government and who are being relentless in their criticism of the government, even though Modi has managed to mute some of the criticism by jailing politicians, by harassing politicians, and by harassing journalists also.
So, Sumit, just in closing then, what do you think the lesson is here globally? Because the evidence is so clear. The worst handling of COVID comes from these populist leaders who ignore science, like Modi, like Trump, like Bolsonaro, and like Boris Johnson. Do you think that there's a wake-up call going on? Because it's so extraordinary to think that Donald Trump controls the Republican Party in this country and is so popular with most Republican politicians. And he's managed to hoist this incredible lie about him winning the election and Biden stealing it, this kind of stop the steal lie that's turned now, it's metastasized into massive voter suppression to the point where the Republicans could actually win in 2022 and 2024. So even though it's so clear what a catastrophe Trump was to this country and to the world, many Americans just simply don't believe it because they're either ignoring the information that's out there, you know, staring them in the face, or they choose to believe propaganda outlets like Fox News. I take it there's a propaganda out. I mean, Modi himself, of course, has used similar propaganda tactics with the BJP, his party. So where do we stand globally? Is there a chance that the people will wake up to these frauds?
Quite frankly, if under these circumstances they do not wake up, I don't know how else to get them to rouse them from their slumber. What I find especially baffling is the seeming stranglehold that Trump exerts on the Republican Party. And by the same token, I find it equally baffling that large numbers of Indians still remain in the thrall of Modi. I don't know how much more discrepant information has to become available to them before their faith in these fraudsters are finally shaken.
Well, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for this opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. His books include India Since 1980, and his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate. where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Stay.